How many times have our patients returned to our office and are just stuck in the cycle of chronic inflammation? We throw everything we have at them, nothing changes, and even our dentists are frustrated. Rather than throwing our hands up and shrugging, we need to be turning to PerioTrace by PerioProtect. I have seen the evidence firsthand and have helped so many hygienists find this resource because it really works, which is why there are so many products on the market now trying to imitate them. The results are speaking for themselves, but rather than going with an unproven product, stick with the only periodontal medicine delivery system cleared by the FDA. And not only that, but their support team is seriously among the best I've ever encountered, from the education to implementation to support when there's the inevitable bumps on the road. They are there for you. If you want to get in contact with them to learn more about how you can treat your patients better, head over to perioprotect.com/RDH. And on that site, at the bottom is a contact form that you can fill out or simply email them directly to ask for help. This is one thing I truly believe should be in every dental practice. perioprotect.com/RDH to stop the cycle of chronic inflammation.
If you want to be the best that you can be, don't pick and choose your skill set here. You're in college to learn how to be a hygienist. No matter what you call it, perio hygienist, restorative hygienist, general practice hygienist, you're still a hygienist. You have all these skill sets. Why not learn it?
I work mostly with children, but since we're dual certified in orthodontics and pediatrics, I do a lot of cosmetic work like composite veneers on adult patients. We can do so much more in this function than just doing traditional hygiene. I just love it. It's amazing.
Just because you don't like it in hygiene school doesn't mean that if you tried it, you wouldn't love it, because that's exactly my situation. I graduated and said, I am never doing restorative again. Didn't like it in school, graduated, got hired in a restorative position, and now I've never looked back and I couldn't be happier.
Get ready for your unofficial dental hygiene podcast. These are the tales of two hygienists, one East Coast RDH and one West Coast Guygenist. Listen as they tackle the profession of dental hygiene with humor and enthusiasm. Now, please join Michelle Strange and Andrew Johnston as they tell you a tale of two hygienists.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of A Tale of Two Hygienists. This is your student-focused roundtable for the month. But before we get into the student roundtable, I want to give a huge shout-out to Q Optics for their continued love and support of our dental hygiene students. You guys, if you have not looked up Q Optics yet, if you are not using Loops yet, you need to make that phone call. You need to send out that email. Every clinician should be wearing Loops. I was fortunate enough, before this pandemic happened, at Chicago Midwinter, to be sized and measured for my Loops myself. And I love them. There are many designs, many different styles, many different options. And right now, because it's been a little bit since we've been in this pandemic, there are many manufacturers creating face shields specifically for use with Loops. And Q Optics is no exception. They have these amazing face shields designed for their Loops. So don't let the pandemic frighten you away from delivering optimal patient care by using your Loops. If you want to know more, check out qoptics.com. And thanks again to Q Optics for their continued support with our students.
Let's get into the student focus roundtable. So at the beginning of the student focus series, that you, this was your brainchild last year in 2019. Isn't that the year? Gosh, they're flying by.
It's the beginning of 2019. We're like, look, the students need a little bit more direction. We really value that. Like, we're so impressed you guys are even listening to this. Let's be honest.
So true. Yes.
So like, let's give them something. They're taking the time to listen to us. Let's give them something that they actually could use.
And you came up with the idea of a round table, and we brought on different people that would talk about one particular topic. And then I kind of hijacked it for 2020 and made it a little more researchy, because that's what I do. But I hope that you guys find it helpful, because what we're aiming to do is bring on people who understand the topic and let them explain to you how they're looking at research and applying it clinically. Because what happens is we graduate with the knowledge we graduate with, and it might be a little I don't want to say up to date. It might not be as up to date because they had to get you graduated, right? But there's stuff on like HPV that, you know, it's ever changing. And so we got to stay on top of that. And so we're going to bring the experts on so that we can teach you how to read the research and apply it to your patient care so you can always be doing that up-to-date, evidence-based clinical practice that we talk about so much. And we hope you enjoy this student-focused episode.
Hey, Michelle.
Yeah?
It's time for the interview.
Oh, but I had something else to say.
We need to let the experts talk now.
Fine.
So welcome, everyone, to the Student Roundtable for this month. We have a special treat, one that if you've listened to the podcast very much, you've heard me talk about restorative hygiene for so long. But I've always felt that I needed a group. I needed all of us that are going to be on this roundtable today to really explain what it is very, very well. And so we have three guests today, and I would like you guys to introduce yourself, and we're going to start with Melissa.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Melissa McCannell. I am the Dental Hygiene Program Director for Pima Medical Institute in Seattle. We are a private for-profit college. We are an accelerated program. In other words, we do our program in 2 years, and I'm very excited to be here and talk about restorative. I think it's a very underutilized skill set that we have, and I love the idea of being able to cheerlead this. So thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Melissa, thank you, because you and I, we go back a few years working kind of at the state level, doing some changes of, you know, what the restorative exam looks like and stuff like that. And you, my friend, first of all of your students love you to death. And I've said this before on the podcast, I'll continue to say it. Your graduates are some of the most well-prepared graduates and also lifelong learners than I've ever seen. And so thank you for all that you do, because you go way above and beyond. So
thank you. Appreciate that.
Andrea, if you will introduce yourself, please.
Absolutely. My name is Andrea Leach, and I am tenured faculty at Columbia Basin College in the Tri-Cities. I'm the restorative lead there. I've been there since 2017, so a little over 3 years now. Like Melissa said, I'm so excited to talk about restorative today. So thank you for having me.
Andrea, and you and I actually go back. This is funny because, like, I actually kind of know you from all three different spaces. Andrea, you and I go back. We're from the same program, and we both worked at the same company afterwards. We didn't really overlap too much at Apple Valley, but I've heard nothing but great things about your skills there. And then when I found out that you're faculty now, I'm like, oh, good. Someone who has practiced and gets it that can actually help all of the students really understand it at such a different level. I'm so happy for you. Congratulations on everything that you're doing, and thank you for being here.
No problem.
Anne, if you will please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Anne Mora. I'm a graduate from Pierce College in Washington, and I have done literally nothing but restorative hygiene since graduating, pretty much. It's definitely my favorite. I don't think I'd do it any other way, which is probably why I'm here today. So thank you for having me as well. I appreciate it.
For sure. And this is, you know, one of the reasons why I'm so happy that you were able to make it today. Anytime that there's a question, anytime that there's a thought, anytime there's anything about restorative and any of the social media stuff that we're a part of together, you have the answer. And maybe it's a little bit biased on my end, but you have the right answer. I'm like, it's not just like, let's just throw out an answer. Like, this is the right way to do things. And I appreciate that, because you're always thinking about, you put the patient first, which is really important, but you talk about teamwork. You celebrate the dental assistants that help you. You celebrate the doctors that you work with. It doesn't ever feel like it's arduous or it's a task or anything like that. And I just love that about you. So thank you for doing that.
It's a ton of fun. That's why I do it.
Okay. So let me backtrack why we're doing this specific episode today. So we were on a podcast, Michelle and I were on a podcast, and it was a dentist. I don't remember where he went to school, Florida or something like that. And he was saying that he had no idea that there was restorative hygienists out there. And I'm like, oh, you sweet little thing out there that not really understanding what's out there in the world. And as I keep talking to more and more people, I do recruiting for the company I work for now. And sometimes they ask, like, who are you? You know, like, I'm like, well, I'm, you know, restorative hygienist out of Washington, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, restorative hygiene, what's that? Hygienists can do that? So there's a whole section of this country who has zero idea that we exist. And then they think that we're just some like magical unicorn beings. And so I'm, and we are, let's be honest, but I want to talk about, I want to give them like an introduction. So we have to start back to the beginning, because that's the way my brain works. It's, you know, chronological and logical. So I want to start back with, what does the programs look like in Washington State for dental hygiene? Obviously, and we're not going to get into like the prereqs, but all of our programs, you know, are really good with the restorative aspect. And so if you guys could each talk a little bit about some of your memories for you, Anne, but also Andrea, like how do you guys introduce that the restorative curriculum into this already really daunting program? And same with you, Melissa.
So we're on a semester schedule. Let me start with that. I know most of the schools in Washington State are quarters. Please correct me if I'm wrong, Andrea, but I think you guys are on 10 weeks. Is that right?
12-week quarters.
Okay. So we have 15 weeks in a semester, and the curriculum introduces restorative in biomaterials, which is semester 3. We have 6 semesters. That's when the curriculum introduces restorative. We introduce restorative day 1 in oral anatomy.
Yes.
So we try to link it together. Students like to compartmentalize. So they'll go, oh, I don't have to worry about that until later. So we say, no, you need to worry about that today, because one of these days you're going to create that picture of a restoration with your own hand. So we introduce them way, way before, just so they can sort of mentally prepare themselves that, oh my God, this is what I'm going to do. Just like we do with anesthesia. Hey, this is what you're going to get to do, but not until X time, but start thinking about it. So we introduce it as early as we can, because restorative is a different skill set. One of the things that I try to instill in my students is, if you want to be the best that you can be, don't pick and choose your skill set here. You're in college to learn how to be a hygienist. No matter what you call it, perio hygienist, restorative hygienist, general practice hygienist, you're still a hygienist. You have all these skill sets. Why not learn it? It's like being taught to learn anesthesia and not use it, because I don't really want to use it. That's where it doesn't make sense to me. And I might be going off on a little tangent here, but that's when we introduce it. We introduce it as early as day 1, and the curriculum introduces it semester 3, which would be 30 weeks into their education.
Does that sound right for you, Andrea? Is that pretty similar?
We are very similar. Like Melissa was saying, we are quarters. We specifically are a 7-quarter bachelor's program. We introduce restorative early on as well. Quarter number 2, specifically, we start with dental materials. But quarter number 1, they do dental anatomy, which is kind of, you know, the first phase going into restorative. So quarter 1's dental anatomy. Quarter 2 is dental materials. Quarter 3, so spring quarter of their first year, is their first actual true restorative course. And that quarter, we go over class 1 amalgams and some of the properties of amalgam and composite, bonding systems, all of that. Summer quarter, so quarter number 4, they learn class 1 composites and class 2 amalgams. Fall, so quarter number 4 of 7, they learn class 2 composites and anteriors. And then their last 2 quarters is just repetition, practicing all of those skills. So basically every quarter builds and gets a little bit more challenging.
Did it feel like that, Anne? Did it feel like they represented themselves in quarter 1? Or do you feel like all of a sudden, oh my gosh, quarter 3, here we go, we're starting to do it on, how'd that work for you?
So first off, it was quite the blur. I'm sure we can agree hygiene school being a blur, but no, we did start essentially from quarter 1. I was fortunate in that I had Kathy Bassett and Sheila Norton as my
shout out. She's been on the podcast multiple times, that Kathy Bassett.
Yes, exactly. She was one of my restorative professors, and we're good friends now, of course. But it was made very clear from the get-go that restorative was definitely a privilege, a hard-earned privilege in this state. And they put so much emphasis on being able to use restorative functions. And Sheila Norton, actually, from day 1, we were kind of heading into dental materials, and she made it very clear that we needed to make sure that we knew the dental assisting side of restorative. And taking that perspective into account with all the dental materials and how to handle them, because I feel like a lot of hygienists that don't practice this regularly kind of forget those things, and it gets lost to the wayside as you go about your career. But that's all a really big part of what we do. It kind of incorporates dental assisting in with restorative hygiene. So we dabbled in it from the jump, and then my professors were really good about letting us play with the dental materials also right away, so that we kind of get our hands in there and feel everything and know how to mess up and know how to fix it, so to speak.
My two earliest memories in school about, so we had Trudy Benzel, well, I think it was my restorative instructor at the time, and she, two things I remember. One, she could whip out an amalgam perfectly like that, and I was like, oh, that looks easy. I can do that. And then I tried and it didn't go that way. So that was like very, very quickly humbling. Two, I remember in dental materials, they would lay out all of the material. There was like 20, and this was like a pop quiz. And the dental assistants could name almost all of them. Some of the ones they didn't know, like Luma or something like that, they weren't really sure about, but pretty much all of them. And here I am with no dental background, whatever, looking at all 20 of these. I got a 0 out of 20 on that pop quiz because I had zero clue. I couldn't even make up the word composite because I didn't know that was a word. You know what I mean? So it was like, it was very interesting. But I want to go back to the grading aspect, because, and you're right, because it is a privilege. And I feel like Trudy made that very clear for us, but it's also, in addition to being, you know, a privilege, it was expected that you do excellent work.
Yes.
That there was a weight put on our shoulders that we were representing a whole profession. And if we mess that up for the profession, like that comes down on you. Like it just felt like, and she was nice about it, but like, that's just, I remember the feeling, oh my gosh, I can't mess this up. And so the grading was strict. And so let me, I guess, and Melissa and Andrea specifically for this part of it, what are the grading criteria and how do you do like your practicals and what kind of hoops do, I shouldn't say it like that, but like what hoops do they have to jump through to be able to pass a class?
We encourage our students to choose their own route as far as boards go. They can do REB or credits. So that's completely up to them. But as far as grading goes in each of the courses, they have a set number of restorations that they have to turn in with due dates and all of that, and set requirements as far as what material they need to use. I do all of the grading, and every restoration has 8 criteria that we grade. We check for submarginal areas, so sub. We check for flash. We check for smoothness, tooth structure damage. We check the contact, bite, anatomy, overhang. So we check it all. And if it's not perfect, you don't get a perfect score for the category. And that's just how it is. We prefer to grade very strict and really push the students, because we know that sometimes after graduation, some of that bar can fall and they don't necessarily put out the best work. And so we really try and challenge them in school and grade them at a really high standard. So that's what we do. We do hold mock boards or practicals, as well as timed carvings throughout every quarter. They have a timed carve where, you know, they have the set amount of time to complete the restoration. And I set those times specifically to a more real world situation. They are not always going to have 4 hours to do a restoration. So those timed carves are interesting. And it's funny because sometimes those are their best ones. The less that they're kind of fidgeting with it and playing with the material, the better it actually turns out. So those timed carves are also very important in our program, as well as the mock boards. And we run the board just like it would be run via credits or REB. So, you know, there's a set time, all the paperwork, the exact restorations that they would be asked to do. So we do all of those things several times throughout the program.
And just before Melissa jumps in with how she does it, I want to be very clear, though. While you say strict, I say objective. So I love that that's the way you grade. But I tell you what, as a grader for these board exams, I'm not strict. I'm objective. I can prove the overhang is there. You know what I mean? Like it's not, we're not out to get anybody, but it, you know, if it's there, it's there. And if it's not, it's not. And if it's not, let's move on. Right? Like that's the way we look at it. Sorry, Melissa, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Yeah. Sounds like that we have a very similar structure as Andrea has. And we have a form which lists the criteria. Basically, it's a rubric, basically. We have the same things. We have the timed. We have the practice ones. They have the requirement sheets. One of the things that we do, we allow a specific number of errors before it's a fail. So let me give you an example. So in semester 4, which is our official first restorative lab 1, on an amalgam, they're allowed 4 errors. So an error could be flash, any kind of flash. I don't care if it's 0.1 or 2 millimeters of flash, it's still flash. So that helps train their eye to see the detail that you need to see when you're working in restorative. So training the eye as well as the hands is a huge part of what we instill in my students. So, and then the next semester restorative lab 2, they can only miss 2 errors on an amalgam before it fails. So it can be any 2 errors. The contact is to the lingual, the contact is to the buccal. If it's an open contact or a major error, it's an automatic. It could be the most beautiful restoration, but if the contact is open, it's a fail. They redo it. Now, having said that, there's no penalty if they fail. So they can fail an amalgam 14 times. What I want them to do is learn it. I don't want them to be worrying about their grade. They'll get a grade, but it's trying to teach them in a way that isn't penalty heavy. And that helps the student learn, because the pressure of not having to create that perfectly or not having to worry about the grade isn't there. So we have a set of requirements, and then we have the requirements is broken down into 3 sections. On this section, it's practice. You just do it. You do it well, we check you off. On the next section, it's a requirement. You have to pass it. And then the 3rd section is a competency. So when you take a competency, you've got 12 minutes to do an amalgam, and you can only have 2 mistakes. So by the time they get to the competency, they're able to do that because they've had so many failures in practice and do over without the penalty.
I mean, it just sounds like it's so outcomes based, right? Like you're working on the outcomes. You're not working about like a grade per se.
I'm not worried about their grade. I'm worried about the outcome. Exactly.
Oh, I love that.
And then when we get to restorative lab 2, we mix them up. We do amalgams and we do composites in together. So we start them out with Sculpey, which my restorative lead, Vicky, was good friends with Sheila Norton. And so those two, when Vicky started teaching restorative for me, we team teach it. Her and she, it was pretty much me, Vicky, and Sheila Norton. I mean, all 3 of us kind of put this plan together at Pima, and we just kind of improved it since the beginning.
We start
them out with Sculpeys. Yeah. So that's how they start getting their carving going. So we start them out, we do 1 class 1, and then we move to class 2 right away. Because basically, once you get that interproximal, it's essentially another class 1. So we kind of blend them a little bit more too. So yes, very outcome based.
I love that. And so when you were doing this, so first of all of this so far is on Typodon, Steniforms, whatever you call them at this point. When they moved you and from this Typodon to patient based, did you feel prepared?
I personally feel like I was well prepared. I actually recall my very first patient day. It was on my boyfriend. so sweet. And the dentist, the restorative dentist that was there for the day, was concerned because I had treatment planned to do 2 restorations on my boyfriend, cross arch. And he was kind of like, no, she can't do that. You guys can't do that. The students can't do that yet. You can't put a rubber dam on cross arch and do that. This is ridiculous. He was trying to say that I couldn't do it. And Sheila actually stepped in and was like, excuse me, Anne can do this. I know she's got this. Just let her do it. Anne can do it. And of course, you know, my boyfriend probably didn't have the best time, you know, with a cross arch rubber dam. But he didn't complain or anything, and I got it done. And I had so much fun doing it. It was very exhilarating. There were typical, you know, jitters for it being the very first day. But clinically, and it just, I felt totally fine. I completely felt like I was in my element. And that goes back to Sheila and Kathy just really preparing us and getting our hands in the materials before really focusing on being graded. I remember Sheila would be like, get that stuff in there, pack it in the dentiform. Who cares if it looks like it's lipstick smeared on a pig's mouth? You know, just put it in there. That was one of my favorite things she's ever said. She's like, it's going to look ugly, but who cares? Just do it. And with the grading, they both graded differently. So I mean, Kathy is very, well, they're both perfectionists, but Kathy Bassett graded fairly strict, but fair. And Sheila was more kind of like, you know, is this functional? It doesn't have to be absolutely perfect, but is it functional? And just combining both of what they've taught me, yeah, just completely prepared. I feel like most of the class went into it very well prepared. Nervous, but prepared.
So how does this change? And Melissa, I'm sorry I cut you off and you're probably going to go into this part, but you know, later on in the program, when we're working on live patients, how does the grading change?
The grading changes not too much. We have a separate set of rubrics that we review with them prior to. We remind them that this, we've got their back, that we are here to, if they get stuck, you know, give us a signal, but it gets a little stricter, of course. So a contact is open, we will fix it right then and there. We'll have the doctor, the dentist come over and do a little box prep and we'll just readjust it. We check every step from rubber dam to placement of whatever materials need to be placed. If it's deep, if we need to do any dical, vitrobot, whatever the material is, we check it step by step by step. So we do a lot of back and forth and running around, and we're just making sure that they see what we see. And then once we see that they've placed the liner and they've done it perfectly for, you know, 3-4 times, then we feel better about like loosening the the lead a little bit, and they get more confident. So we check them step by step by step as we go along, and then we grade appropriately from there. So failing a restoration on a patient, again, we try to take that word away so that they can learn and be productive. And it doesn't have to be pretty. It doesn't have to be functional. So we make corrections if the filling ends up with an open contact and it's the end of clinic and the patient has to come back. They are penalized for that. But we don't try to fail them. We'll give them, instead of, you know, if the contact was open, but the occlusion is beautiful, it's a redo. Patient comes back and we give them the lowest passing score that they can receive because they fix it and they fix it well. So once they fix it and they fix it well, they deserve a passing grade for it. It might not be 100, but it's a 77, which is our lowest passing score. And the students are fine with that because it's a learning moment. And so that's how we approach it with a patient.
I like that approach. Andrea, how does it change for you guys when you guys are starting to see patients now, as far as like who does the grading and how does that work?
Pretty similar to Melissa. We grade every step as well. There's two separate rubrics, one for the actual restoration and then a separate rubric for the appointment, you know, the anesthetic, the assisting, the setup, the sterile chain, all of that. So that's very similar. In contrast to Melissa, however, I use the exact same rubric as I do on Typodonts with the same 8 criteria. And my thought process on that is I'm not going to grade any differently than we treat the restorations in the lab. I'm not going to grade you any easier just because it's a patient. I'm going to hold you to the exact same standard. I'm typically in every clinic when there's restorative going on. So I kind of man that restorative bay. So I do all of the grading there. Unless I can't be in the clinic, then we have other calibrated instructors who will step in. But yeah, we're, you know, very strict. Patient care is very important. And if something needs to be fixed, then definitely we'll fix it as far as, you know.
So that's the hygiene, the instructors are doing the grading also. Like the dentists are not doing grading for any of these parts. Is that correct?
Exactly. All doctor does is he'll confirm treatment, will anesthetize, he or she will come in and prep, and then that's it. The instructor, which is typically me and the student, and like Melissa said, anytime they need help, we're there. You know, just let us know. It's not a sink or swim type of situation. But yeah, it's doctor's pretty much out of it at that point, unless the student calls me over and there's an issue like an open contact. We'll get doctor involved, have him or her come in, reprep, and consult us on what he would like us to do. But otherwise, it's pretty much the restorative instructor and the student.
I love that. Now, how much, okay, so actually, I think I might have glossed over this part. There's two really important components that you guys have mentioned in these step-by-step. So one, in the state of Washington, we do all restorations, all classes, all materials, all of that, which is not the same everywhere for expanded functions type situations. So we have license to do all of that. The second thing is local anesthesia. You both mentioned it, that as far as like getting patients numb, I remember when we were doing it, we had our, I think it was February reb was for local anesthesia. And then after that, we could kind of just give anesthetic as much as we needed during those appointments and didn't have to, you know, keep getting doctor and things like that. So for someone who's wondering, like, how did that work when you have, you know, 4 to 8 students doing restorative lab at one time for anesthetic purposes, that's generally a lot of the students are capable of doing it at that point. I want to talk though about the board exam. So Anne, you took Reb though, Reb Restorative, right?
Yes.
And then I took Reb Restorative, and now credits has come in. And so now they have two options. And Andrea, you mentioned that the students are allowed to choose. So how does that, when you're educating them, how does that change how you educate them based on which board exam they're taking?
We would love to teach both credits and Reb. Unfortunately, we just focus on the credit side of it. So we kind of go that route, but we encourage them, you're welcome to take either one. And I've had students in the past who have chosen to take Reb, even though they were taught Ford's credits, and they've always been successful. They've always, you know, done really well. Really, the only difference there is those students who have chosen to do Reb are, you know, they just have to kind of study the manual and look at the process and the paperwork that's a little bit different. Otherwise, they're just as prepared as if they're going to take credit.
Are the preps differently for Reb? I know, I mean, back when I was in these discussions, it was different, but did they change the criteria?
Yes. So credits is always number 3 MO, and the student can choose amalgam or composite. And the second restoration is 9 mesiolingual composite. So that's credits. Reb is similar to the way it used to be, where there's 4 different prep options, all posteriors. There's no anteriors on Reb. So it's still very similar to what it was when we took it all those years ago. But I want to say, if I'm not mistaken, and one of you can help me out if you know better, I want to say they've moved away from the Kilgore titanate to the Accidental. So the teeth are a little bit different.
I have no knowledge about that specifically. But yeah, I mean, that's what I remember. I remember going in and there'd be like X's on the teeth that they chose for you to do. And they told you which one was composite and which one was amalgam. And they're always class 2 and you always had to figure that part out. So, but Melissa, do you change how you are doing your educational process based on the board exam?
No, we don't. A restoration is a restoration. So the only thing that's different is preparing them. So we do let them know they can take either. We host credits at Pima. So we let them know if you want to take Reb, you're going to have to sign up at a different school. And we help them. And typically it's the students that want to live in Nevada, because that's the only state on the West Coast for us that doesn't acknowledge credits for whatever reason, I believe. But we teach them the same. Class 2 is a class 2, whether you take credits or you take Reb. We teach them anterior. I believe Reb only does 2 posterior fillings. They don't do any anterior. I had heard that they were talking about it, but I don't know that it was, you know, it came to fruition yet. Mm-hmm. But they'll choose, you actually have, I think, 12 different restorations that they pick the night before. So they do MOs and DOs, and the candidate doesn't know which one for Reb. So for credits, it's the 3 MO and then the number 9 ML. So, but we teach essentially the same. We teach to credits criteria or board criteria, and we teach to patient criteria. So we always say you need to do this for board. Now a patient's not going to have this kind of anatomy because you have to consider what their teeth look like. So that's what I mean by teaching to patients and teaching to board. Reality versus, you know, dentiform versus a person. So but we teach the same.
And I think it's a testament to both your programs for sure that the success rate is unchanged no matter what exam they're going to be taking. And I love that you mentioned that, Andrea. So I want to talk about how this is just a sticking point for me. I don't know if it's a matter of pride. I don't know what exactly it is, but how many exams do hygienists in Washington have to pass to get a license? And do you remember the process?
Yes.
Good. Let's talk. Let's list them for everyone.
Okay. Oh my goodness. I believe there was an ethics board, and then local anesthesia, written local anesthesia, clinical, restorative clinical, you know, reb or credits. It was just reb when I was a student. Oh my gosh.
Your hygiene. I'm like,
you're national.
Yeah. I'm like,
your national.
My hands are starting to sweat just like thinking about this, guys. I'm having like PTSD.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous the amount, right? Like, we're already at what, 5 or 6 exams to get our license. Mm-hmm. So we have these 6 that we have to take. On anywhere for your licenses, does it say anything about being EFTA?
No, you have to do that separate.
Yep, you have to do that separate.
Mm-hmm. So EFTA in so many other states means something completely different. And so all of the hygienists that have gone through the programs in Washington State and some of the programs in Oregon, but that apply for a license in Washington for your normal license, you have all of these things and you're not anything, I don't want to say not anything special. You're very special, but there's no like extra credentials. So in Florida, we have these CRDHs, these certified registered dental hygienists, which means they can give local anesthesia. That's all it means. And then other states have these little C's that mean different things. There's no rhyme or reason to what they're doing, but it gives them some elevated whatever. So for us, we have this baseline, but we also have other licenses that are available in the state, right?
For hygienists? The limited license? Are you talking about the limited license, Andrew?
Yep. So limited license, you don't have to do restorative. So if you are in the military doing all these other things, you still have to take a lot of exams. You still have to do all these things. The education has to be there, but it's, you know, you have your limited license. And it used to be non-renewable, but now I think it's renewable year to year.
It is. Yep.
Yeah. So I really, really like laid into this deeply because I want to talk about portability. Because that is a hot button topic. And I think you and I actually might even differ on this based on your background, and maybe not. But I want to know, we have all of these things, this education. I was looking at a program in Texas the other day, and it had like 48 credit hours to be a hygienist. And then I was looking at Yakima, I think it was 119 or something like that. So I'm looking at all this portability issue, and I want to know, without sounding arrogant and whatever, like where do Washington hygienists feel on the portability issue? Yeah. I've been accused of being incredibly arrogant on this. I'll just tell you, but I still want military that, and this is why I'm bringing you specifically in. You know, there have to be exceptions for people who are relocating for a certain reason.
Yes.
But we work hard to get our license.
There's a pretty heavy military presence here in Washington State. And I think that's kind of what creates more of a buzz. There's so many people who PCS over here to Fort Lewis, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and the wives, the military wives that are hygienists, feel kind of stuck. Or, yeah, they feel like they can't find any employment. Or like, hey, well, I'm only going to be here for what, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years, and then I'm probably going to go back home. So why should I bother, you know, going the extra mile and doing all these extra classes and things like that and getting all these other certifications if I'm just going to leave back to my state that doesn't require me to do this anyways? And so as a former military spouse, I do personally somewhat understand that, but I'm so on the fence with this because at the same time, I know how rigorous my training was. And I remember crying all the time and it just being so intense, but so well worth it. It's hard to imagine. And I don't mean to sound arrogant when I say this either, just kind of giving that away to someone to be able to find employment here and potentially take an employment opportunity away from someone else who went through all of this stuff here in the state. It's hard to just say, oh, well, it's okay if you just kind of do my job, but not all of it. And we'll just be fine with that. We'll just let it go. And it's okay that I did probably double the amount of credit hours as you. And it's okay. We have like the same license. I don't know. It does bother me somewhat when I hear at some of the association meetings and things like that, that maybe the dental association, I don't really want to point my finger. I don't really know who all is initiating some of these talks, but in regard to portability, I almost feel like it's kind of diminishing what we worked so hard to put together here and that we uphold as a profession in Washington State, to just let someone come in and not be held to the same standards, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Andrew, do you have thoughts? You're shaking your head, but you're also kind of like looking at me like, please don't ask me to say anything that's going to get myself in trouble.
No. Well, where my mind keeps going with this is, yes, the portability of dental hygiene licenses, but my mind just keeps trailing off to the desire for, you know, certain groups in the dental field to want to expand the functions of dental assistants. That's been a hot button in Washington State recently, specifically using Cavitrons and probing and EFTAs as far as expanded function dental assistants, placing restorations. And I worked with one and she was wonderful, but all she had to do to place restorations was, you know, do some weekend courses over 5 or 6 months, I want to say, and that was it. And I just thought, all the hours I spent doing restorative, and you did some weekend courses in on the West Side, and now all of a sudden you're doing all of my restorations. So that's where my mind keeps going, is trailing off to the dental assistant side of it. So
yeah, that's a tough issue. Melissa?
Part of my issue with this, and I completely agree with the standard, you know, we all worked hard. Okay, so that's one thing. The second thing is, if somebody comes from a CODA accredited program, they come from a CODA accredited program. So CODA has said that's a good program. They're valid. They are accredited. They're good to go. No matter whether we agree with how many hours they had to do or how many hours they didn't have to do or how many more we had to do than them, they are a CODA accredited program. So there's a certain acknowledgement we need to give to that.
Sure.
And then, for the EFTA, I get a lot of EFTAs that come into the hygiene program. They see it as a step into hygiene, which blew my mind when I first started asking this question, because my thought, because when EFTA first became the thing in Washington, I thought, wow, okay, that's a way to do what we're doing. But the EFTA students, and this is not a research, this is just me asking questions, not an official research. They say it's a step for them to get into hygiene, which I found surprising. Mm-hmm. So my question goes back to, why is it that the EFTA programs can just do that minimum versus the hygiene? Why isn't it equivalent? And I don't have the answer to that, but why isn't it? Okay, I get that hygiene students have all this other things that they have to do, so that might be the difference. Mm-hmm. Is it an equivalent? Is it one for one? Are the clock hours one for one? The advantage the EFTA has is that's all they're studying. The disadvantage the hygiene student has is that's not all they're studying. So I don't know enough about EFTA programs. I think there's only one or two EFTA programs left in Washington. Can somebody tell me that?
I temp sometimes at the South Puget Sound Community College. And from my understanding, they have an EFTA program there. So I temp with the dental assisting students. I believe they're CODA accredited for dental assisting. And while I'm in there helping them out, they have a room in the back where there are other students practicing restorative. And I'm good friends with one of the instructors there. Her name is Evie Harry, and she's amazing. And I see some of the restorations. They're great. I don't know if that is a CODA accredited type of thing. I'm not super familiar with all the parameters of the EFTA program, but I know that they do host one there and the students can come and do the classes at night and everything. And all the students that have come out of there are amazing. I have no qualms with people who come out of programs like that. Their work is definitely on point.
For sure. I mean, I want to very clarify for the audience, you know, our EFTAs in Washington State are placing restorations. And that's what we're talking about specifically. And they go through a program. A lot of them are actually through the hygiene program, or they used to be through the hygiene program. Or same location, at least. I don't know who the instructors are. And they have to pass board exams as well.
Only have to pass one.
It's the restorative
board. They do the REB board. And I think that's...
Right. I guess that's kind of what I'm saying, is that they still pass the restorative board exam.
Yes.
And I remember when I graduated... They allegedly, I think that's the word I'm supposed to use, allegedly made it harder during that year, because that's one of the first years that all the EFTAs were going through that same restorative board. And so they still take a board exam. It's I guess what I'm trying to do is differentiate between other states where it is you take a night class and you get someone to sign a piece of paper and you're done.
Yes.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, we're not going to solve the portability issue here, but I want to lay it out. Like, here's some pros and some cons. There are definitely, to your credit, Melissa, these CODA accredited programs. Why can't we have similar things like kind of across the board, like a national license?
Exactly.
The perio portion of licensure. I will throw one little monkey wrench into this whole entire thing. That's going to further make it a hurdle. In the state of Florida, a foreign trained dentist can be a hygienist.
Tech license. Yep.
They still have to take an exam and stuff, but I know personally, not within my company, but I know personally some things that have happened where these, you know, foreign trained dentists or hygienists don't even know how to pair a chart. They don't know how to probe. And they would have to go through training on how to even do that aspect of it. So then when they have a license in Florida, then can they translate it over to Washington and you know, to Texas and to Michigan or whatever? Like, I feel like there is so much more to this issue that we all need to be thinking about rather than just the simple fact of we do hygiene here, you do hygiene there. It's the same thing. It's not. It's a much
more complex system. It's not. And I can speak to that, Andrew. I had a student that was a foreign trained dentist. She got licensed in Florida and tried to come to Washington. And she came to me I didn't know who she was. She just specifically, for whatever reason, she sought me out and was asking questions about my program, the fact that she was foreign trained, that she was already a hygienist. And then the question started, so if you're a hygienist, why are you looking into a hygiene program? Oh, I'm a hygienist from Florida. Okay, what does that mean? What does that mean? You know, and so we got into that. So that was a few years ago, and that was my first exposure to that law, I guess, in Florida, that they do allow. And so that's what happens. They come in through Florida, get a hygiene license, and depending on what state. So for Washington state, she got the kibosh. We're like, sorry, you have to go to school. I don't care if you come to Pima. I don't care if you go to Shoreline. I don't care if you go to Pierce. But you have to go to school to get licensed in Washington state. So she ended up having to go through the hygiene program and moved on. But that is a crack in the system, so to speak.
Sure is. It's a glare.
That is crack. Quite scary when you speak about portability.
Yeah. So anyways, I just want to put this on your guys' radar for students, new grads, whoever's listening to this episode. Like, there's so much more to this topic, and it's not a simple fix. I know we're running out of time. We're actually already gone over, and I'm really sorry. I hope you guys have just a couple more minutes. I want to go into now, we've passed the boards, we have our license. What does private practice look like for a restorative hygienist?
Amazing.
One of the things, Andrew, that I struggle with is the fact that a lot of dentists don't know that we have the restorative capabilities. So when I go backward in time with that, I have spoken to some hygienist colleagues of mine that worked at the University of Washington. And if she used to go into the University of Washington dental program and teach them what we do, because even those students don't know that they can utilize their hygienist the way that we can be utilized in a private practice. So when I'm speaking to my students, I tell them, do not assume that your dentist employer knows that you can do this. Take pictures of your work, add it to your portfolio, show them why you deserve whatever salary it is that you're negotiating. Mm-hmm. This is what I can do. So I think that's part of the issue is even our own dentists out of dental school in Washington State don't know that a hygienist can do restorative. It blows my mind.
They conveniently forgot to look at the law on that one during their log exam.
Right.
No big deal. Their supervision. Okay. Andrea and Ann, how do you utilize that function?
Oh my goodness. I basically am purely restorative all day. I'm very fortunate. I work for Dr. Capus here in Tumwater, and his wife is a hygienist and his sister is a hygienist. So he's well schooled in what we can and can't do. So I feel like I can make his schedule so profitable, and he uses me to like the furthest extent of my ability all day, every day. The way that it changes the schedule flow, the way that it affects the production number and things like that, it's insane what you can do when you add a restorative hygienist into the mix with any dental office.
I have to say that's fantastic. Good for you.
Yeah, I know. I'm really lucky. And I didn't even know who my employer was. I never looked for a job. Kathy Bassett kind of called me and was like, hey, there's this guy and he's great. And if I could go back in time and work for him, I totally would. And I actually replaced his hygienist of almost 30 years.
Wow.
Just I catwalked right into that position. And I've been there ever since graduating. And I've never been happier. I wouldn't have it any other way. And every single prep, every day, every patient, everything is completely different. Not saying that traditional hygiene isn't worth my time, but it kind of seems very repetitive and mundane in comparison to what I get to do on a daily basis with all of my restorative cases. And I work mostly with children, but since we're dual certified in orthodontics and pediatrics, I do a lot of cosmetic work like composite veneers on adult patients. We can do so much more in this function than just doing traditional hygiene. I just love it. It's amazing.
Do they set aside a production column for you to do, or is it you just look at the multiple columns and you just insert yourself wherever?
First and foremost, I will say my office is very unique in that my employer, there's just one of him and he runs 8 columns.
Oh my gosh.
All by himself. Yes.
Wow.
Between him and I, there are 8 columns. We tend to focus on the first 1 or 2 columns, have most of the restorative, but him and I are ping-ponging between patients. It's like a really fine dance we're doing. I've got a radio hooked into my ear, and everybody just kind of lets me know. The assistants will get the patients ready for anesthetic. They'll place topical. They'll be like, hey, Anne, I'm ready for, and we can't say anesthetic in front of the kids. They'll say, Anne, I'm ready for Annie at chair, blah, blah, blah. So I'm literally just on my feet mostly all day unless I'm sitting down and doing a restoration, ping-ponging. And I do hygiene too. I do all the scaling. My office, even though it's a children's office, we don't do fake prophylaxis. I actually sit down and do the scaling. The assistants don't just coronal polish in my office. So yeah, it's very busy. There's not really any downtime at all, but that's kind of my cup of tea. And with those first 2 columns being mostly restorative, I'd have to say in at least one of the columns, my production is, it's goodness.
You don't have to say on air.
Yeah. Right.
Don't worry about that. But it's a lot. I mean, it's way more than traditional.
It's quite
hygiene.
A bit. And my columns do make a large portion of the production for the day. It keeps my boss's number up. And knowing that if I were working in a regular office, I'd probably be making, I don't know, maybe $300-$400 a patient just for a cleaning versus what I'm making in 40 minutes to do like a moto, like a back-to-back on, you know, like an 8-year-old. It's just completely different. Definitely more productive than traditional hygiene, I think.
Andrea, what was the model that you worked in?
I worked in a corporate type of environment, and I think the roles of restorative hygienist in a corporate type environment versus a private practice can be very different. I was in charge of 3 restorative columns, but 5 columns total, 2 of which were prophys. So that was very different. I also did a working interview in a private office. I was interviewing for a hygiene position, but I actually kind of took the step and told the doctor, hey, you know, I come from a restorative background and I know that you're looking for a traditional hygienist, but hey, let me show you what I can do. He allowed me to do a few restorations and he ended up offering me a job as a restorative hygienist. So I think there are offices that either they don't realize what restorative hygienists can do, or there might be some type of kind of distrust or this, you know, control that they don't want to give up. So I just encourage restorative hygienists to just, you know, say, hey, let me prove it to you. Give me a few columns, or let's do it for a day and just and see what you think, and let me show you what I can do. So I just think there's a lot of offices that don't quite understand that we can do restorations and do them well. And sometimes there's even patients that get a little confused, like, wait a second, are you doing my restoration? Where's the doctor? And it's like, no, you know, you're in good hands. So it just takes a little bit of proving, and I think we can push the doctors to kind of see that side of it.
of all of I guess of your colleagues of your graduating class or whatever, what would you say, how many people are actually practicing in the restorative function on their, like, a day to day?
That's a hard question to answer, Andrew. I would say a very small percentage. I don't know if I can give you a number. You know, if we graduate 28 of them, I would say probably 8 to 10 of them, but it takes some convincing. You know, I think my older graduates, my older alumni come back and say, hey, guess what? My doctor finally is letting me do restorative. So that's the glitch. They want to do it, but the doctors don't necessarily can't see beyond whatever it is, whatever barrier they have to allow it to happen in their practice. So sometimes it takes some coaching. You know, we're all educators on whether you're in private practice full time or you're teaching, we're all educators. So we have to educate the dental community that this is our practice and this is how I can improve our practice. But that takes some convincing. Sometimes it's a year or two after they graduate, they actually get their hands into some restorative, which is too bad.
And how many of your former classmates are doing restorative, would you say?
Honestly, I don't think any of them are. I believe one was trying to, and it didn't quite happen. I think the doctor was telling her, like, yeah, I'll think about it. But it was never really established for her to do that on a regular basis. And I'm not sure if she's still with that particular office. It was a corporate office at the time. But as far as I know, I think I might be the only one in my class, and that's from 2016, that's practicing restorative on a daily basis. I'm kind of sad about that.
That is, that's too bad.
And I didn't win the restorative award, which kind of blows my mind. Yeah, makes me sad.
Andrea, how many would you say from your former classmates?
You know, I graduated about a decade ago. I didn't really keep in contact with very many of them. So I don't have the slightest idea how many of my classmates do or have done restorative. As far as my colleagues at CBC, very few, maybe one or two, you know, a few restorations if their patient cancels. But as far as being a restorative hygienist, none of them, very few.
So it's so interesting. And I think, you know, I feel very fortunate to have been a restorative hygienist, I think, for most of my career, which towards the last couple of years, of course, it kind of turned into more of a hybrid situation working at a corporate setting where I would do a lot of restorative and they would have columns for me on certain days, depending on patient flow and the needs and things like that. Or if a patient didn't show up, my brother, as I think all of you guys know, graduated the same year as me and he does a lot of restorative too. So between the two of us, we do a lot, but I don't know that there are many other from our graduating class either that does very much. And so it's interesting to me though, because for me, restorative, and going back to what you were saying about the repetition of perio or as traditional hygienist, there's something with restorative that gives you an instant gratification where when you see this perio case that is not responding the way you want to, it can be very frustrating. And so you're in it for the long haul with perio. Like you're going to be grinding and hopefully you'll get incremental improvements over the decades and stuff that you work with these people, hopefully. Okay. So I think this is the last question. What are the things that you think people don't quite understand about a restorative hygienist that you wish they would?
One of the things that I see, which I find disappointing, and sometimes it's through like the professional website, but I hear a lot of hygienists, I hear negativity when it comes to restorative, like, why do we have to do this? Who wants to do restorative anyway? There's that side of it that I find very disappointing. I equate that in my mind. It's almost like saying, well, who wants to scale anyway? To me, it's the same. Hygiene, anesthetic, restorative. That's what a hygienist is. And I find it disappointing, and I wish hygienists and hygiene students across the board would look at restorative as not this option, but this is what I'm getting into when I sign up, when I decide I want to be a hygienist. I'm going to do anesthesia, I'm going to do restorative, and I'm going to do hygiene. That's what I wish other people would sort of come into my circle and realize that this is what a hygienist is. Why limit yourself to only one or two skill sets? We have very few skill sets that define us. It's always being trying to give it away. Somebody's always trying to give away our skill set to somebody else, whether it's an EFTA or an assistant. So we have to take those three major skill sets that we have and embrace them and hold on tight. I feel as if we did that more, it wouldn't be as easy to delegate our skill set to an EFTA or to a dental assistant, and we wouldn't have this continuous fight. Now, this is a whole probably another conversation, Andrew, but that's what I wish other people would know. It's not a restorative hygienist. It's not a perio hygienist. It's a hygienist. And a hygienist means all of those things.
I love it. Okay, Anne, something that you wish that people would maybe understand better.
You know, I think this is more geared towards our dentist peers, because when I go to conventions and things like that with my office, well, not now because of COVID, but a lot of the fellow dentists at these conventions would kind of be like, wait, you're not a dentist? You're just a hygienist, but you do your boss's fillings, because they're from all over the place. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, but why would he hire you? Why would your boss hire you to do this and not an EFTA? It would cost him way less money to do this. It just doesn't logistically make sense that your employer is using you for restorative. And I don't know if this is completely correct because I haven't totally checked, but my professors would always make it a point to tell us as students that in our hygiene curriculum, we actually spend more time, more hours learning restorative, like focused on these restorations than dentists do in their program, because they have so many other things that they have to learn. We've kind of narrowed in on restorative and we learn it so well. We're graded, so I don't want to say harshly, but we're held to such a high standard. I mean, why wouldn't you use someone who's somewhat specialized in this more than you probably have to make, you know, everything more productive or flow better, however you want to put it. But I wish that other dentists could see the value that we can generate in their practice and with their patients. We are hygienists, you know, we do traditional hygiene and things like that, but we're so specialized as well. And to just kind of let that go to the wayside, I just think it's such a waste. So I wish they'd kind of look at us as a whole and take us in as a whole and not just focus on like, hey, you know, just do some cleanings and that's all I need you for.
Andrea?
My answer's twofold. What I would like other hygienists to understand is how rewarding restorative can be. And just because you don't like it in hygiene school doesn't mean that if you tried it, you wouldn't love it, because that's exactly my situation. I graduated and said, I am never doing restorative again. Didn't like it in school, graduated, got hired in a restorative position. And now I've never looked back and I couldn't be happier. So A, just try it and see if you like it. B, it's super rewarding. I've done 6 through 11 buildups and completely change someone's smile and them just burst into tears when they look in the mirror. So restorative has a rewarding side of it that traditional hygiene doesn't always have. So that's what I would like other hygienists to understand. What I would like dentists and patients to understand is really going to piggyback on what Anne was talking about. And that's how much training, how many hours we've put into it, how many hundreds of restorations we've done that were nitpicked by our instructors, looking at every single little thing and just kind of torn apart objectively. So I would love for dentists and patients to understand that, you know, we're trained and we can be pretty darn good. So, yeah.
Thank you all for being with me today doing this. I think this is going to be a really good episode for so many people to learn about what we do here. Well, I'm not even in Washington anymore. I'm in Florida, but here in Washington is what I mean.
You left us. It's okay.
I know. I went to an
op. You can always come back. The other day.
I don't know if they'll let me back in the state right now, but I went into an op and I sat with a patient and I wasn't doing anything clinical. I was just having a discussion. I'm like, I miss this. So if someone wants to reach out to you after hearing this episode, for better or for worse, how can they get a hold of you? Melissa?
You can get a hold of me at my email address, mmccannel@pmi.edu.
Andrea?
My email address is also wonderful. It's A for Andrea Leach, L-E-A-C-H, @columbiabasin.edu.
And Anne?
And my email is akmora@outlook.com.
Fantastic. And those will all be in the show notes. So if you are on the road and you can't write this down, then just click on the show notes and you'll be able to see it. All right. Thank you again, everyone, for doing this. I really appreciate it. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We hope you guys enjoyed this roundtable. Thank you to our guests for bringing all their advice and their research that they found for us. And again, follow us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook. You can always go to our website, attila2hygienist.com. We would love your feedback. And don't forget to share this episode and rate and review us on any of your listening apps.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, y'all.